Hello, everybody. Jan Rutherford here with Self-Reliant Leadership. I'm really excited to bring Carol Robin to the show today. She just wrote this book, Connect, and we're going to talk all about it. And you ever meet somebody and you felt like you've known them a whole long time? That's kind of how I felt just in our preview meeting you, Carol. I felt like I've known you a long time. Welcome.
Oh, thank you, Jan. So happy to be here.
Well, for our audience who isn't familiar with you, a little background. We know you taught at Stanford a long time. You're very entrepreneurial. You hang with a great crowd of world-renowned thought leaders. You're a world traveler. What else do we need to know about you as an author of this book?
Well, you know, I think maybe the first thing I'd want you to know is that it's why I wrote the book. Because it'll tell you a lot about who I am. And I co-wrote the book. I co-wrote the book with my mentor and a longtime colleague at Stanford. And we wrote the book because for decades, in his case, many more decades than me, we taught this course called Interpersonal Dynamics, also known as Touchy-Feely at Stanford. Known affectionately by the students as Touchy-Feely. And what we found was that the course literally changed their lives. They talked about it. I mean, thousands of alums said this was a transformational experience. And they write to us 10 years later saying, this course continues to pay off. I just got promoted. I just became a CEO because of what I learned. This course just saved my marriage. This course just helped me reconcile my relationship with my mom. And the publisher who came to us said, how come there's not a book on this? And we said, well, you know, this is, you don't learn to develop deeper, more functional relationships unless you engage with other people. And we're not sure that people will do that if they just read a book. And he said, so let's see, this life-changing course and everything it teaches is only available to the lucky and privileged folks who get into the Stanford Graduate School of Business and your class. How is that okay with you? So then we realized we needed to write the book. And where that connects to who I am is that I've had six different careers. I am not a career academic. My first career was in sales and marketing and industrial automation. I was the first woman hired into a non-clerical job in 1975 at a very large Fortune 500 company. And then I did a stint as an executive recruiter, and I had my nonprofit era when my kids were little, and then I was a consultant, and I went back to school and got a master's and then a PhD, and then I was a consultant for a while, and then I had a very windy road to Stanford. And by the way, I left Stanford in 2017 and started a nonprofit called Leaders in Tech, which is the goal of it is to help create healthier, more functional, and more inclusive cultures in Silicon Valley. And basically, I'm bringing everything I taught at the Stanford Business School to CEO founders in the Valley, pre-IPO. And so, you know, but now, and funny story, at my dissertation committee meeting, I sat down in my committee and I said, look, I'm not getting a PhD because I ever intend to teach. I think, you know, teaching is for those who don't know how to do. Talk about a bias. And I said, I just, you know, I'm moving more and more into this field of leadership development, and I'm going to be dealing with, you know, I don't want to mess with people's lives and not know what I'm doing. So that's why I'm getting a PhD. And here I am 30 years later, and I will say that I am a teacher. And that I believe I was put on the planet to be a teacher and to teach precisely what I teach, which I also try to live, which is why your introduction of me was so lovely, because I try to show up congruent with what I teach and what I think is important. It's one of the reasons I became known as the queen of touchy-feely at Stanford, at the business school.
Carol, tell me about, I love what the publisher said, taking, an experience and putting it into a book and changing lives. Mm-hmm. Because before the show, you said, everybody believes, their book is going to change lives. So how did you approach that challenge of taking something that's very experiential and saying, well, how do we thread this book together?
Yeah, wonderful question. By the way, that's why it took us 4 years to write the book. Mm-hmm. I've been telling people writing the book was like being pregnant for 3.5 years and in labor for 6 months. And that was certainly the biggest challenge. Aside from the fact that we probably had 3 volumes and we needed to write one book. So we did 2 things that I think really help. The first is that we bring the concepts to life through the stories of 5 different relationships. A man and a woman who work together, a married couple, two buddies, 2 girlfriends that have been friends since college and are now in their 40s, a father and a daughter. And so the concepts are brought to life through their stories and the arc of their relationships. And those stories, by the way, those relationships are an amalgamation of true stories that we've, people we've known. They're not totally made up. Then, at the end of every chapter, we ask the reader to put themselves in the place of one of the 2 protagonists that they just read the story of. And we say to them, so what would you have done if you were Maddie? What would Adam's reaction, how do you think you would have reacted to Adam's reaction? What would you have done next? So we actually invite them to engage with the characters. And then we have a little assignment for them, because of course we are teachers, that says pick someone in your life and based on what you just learned in this chapter, go try something. And we have specific examples of things you might want to go try. And we say, after you've done that, stop and think a little bit about what are you learning about yourself. One of the reasons the course was so life-changing is that one of the things we say in the course and we say in the book is it takes 2 to know 1. We don't really know ourselves until, we certainly don't know how effective we are, especially as leaders, unless somebody tells us. No, and unless we create, cultures and circumstances where people will tell us, then we really don't know. So it behooves us to show up in ways that invite honesty and authenticity. And I'm not saying everything, but I am saying truth telling. You know, I've had many clients over the years because I'm also an executive coach and I've done all kinds of other things. I've had clients to say to me, but God, Carol, it takes so much time. It takes so much time to give people feedback. Mm-hmm. And I say to them, well, I'll quote one of my colleagues at Stanford who says, well, actually, there's nothing more efficient than the truth. Mm-hmm. How much do you want to make people guess? And by the way, how much do you want to delude yourself? Or do you really want to know? But by the way, if somebody says, that's the 3rd assignment you've given me that's unclear, and I'm feeling more and more frustrated because I don't know if I'm delivering what you want. If I don't make it okay for somebody to tell me that, if I say, well, that's clearly your problem, well, they're probably not going to do that again.
Yeah. Well, this morning we had a podcast interview with someone who's a Stoic philosopher.
Uh-huh.
And it was interesting because my big takeaway at the end was, we're all just too busy. We've got to slow down. And I'm hearing that in you. I mean, because what you're really saying to the reader is, boy, there's a lot of reflection that you need to do.
Yes. And in fact, think about this, you're a coach also. One of our roles as coaches is to have our clients slow down enough to extract the lessons there are to be extracted from their experience. Otherwise, they just go from one experience to the next. They never learn anything.
Right. Well, I'd love to Two things. I'd love to go down a little bit of a track of, you know, what are the problems you're seeing in the work world of not being connected the right way, and some of the things that we need to do. And and I'm guessing you're going to touch on the fact that there's this thing called a pandemic going on right now. And
you think
it's even harder than ever to be connected. And one of the big things we hear probably from all our clients is not just how do I connect better internally, culturally with my organization, but what about clients? How am I can't go have a coffee with them. I can't know, take them donuts. How am I supposed to do this in a two-dimensional
setting? Absolutely. And so, let's start with something I always told my students, and we say in the book, people do business with people. They don't do business with ideas or money or strategies or products. They do business with people. And we were used to doing things a certain way pre-pandemic that somewhat addressed the people part. By the way, I don't think we ever did that great a job on that front. But we certainly had more opportunities, or at least we were used to having certain opportunities. But here's the thing that I think has become even more foregrounded for all of us, is that there is a difference between contact and connection. So you and I can have a conversation that's very task-oriented about what needs to be done, and we will have had contact, but in all probability, we will not have in any way deepened our connection. And so some of the things that the book talks about, which is what does it take to really build connection, which are things like being vulnerable enough to let the other person know you a little bit more so that they feel a little bit more comfortable allowing themselves to be a little more known. Because by the way, vulnerability and authenticity are reciprocal. The more I hold my cards close to my vest, the more you're going to hold yours. And while there's some, well, I'm not saying, you know, you should say anything to anybody. I am saying that most of us err on the side of not saying very much. That's really meaningful. And so
is that because we're trying to, you know,
because it's risky, Jan. Because it's risky. And we acknowledge that, we understand that, we write about that. It's one of the reasons we talk about something called the 15% rule in the book, which is you have your comfort zone where you don't even think twice about what you say and do. And you have your danger zone, which is I'd never in a million years say that. And you've got the zone in the middle, which is where we learn. We have to step outside our comfort zone enough to learn, which makes us a little uncomfortable. But our students used to say, but the minute I'm outside my comfort zone, how do I know I'm not in my danger zone? And we used to say, well, try stepping 15% outside your comfort zone, just a little bit. You'll know. Yeah. You'll know if you take a little risk. And then you get a chance to see how did that land. And then maybe the other person will stretch. And by the way, an interesting thing happens. Once I've stretched 15% out and the world did not end, then I'm like, oh, I've got a new comfort zone and it's a little bigger. And then I can expand a little bit beyond that. So
what about the, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah,
what about the
ahead.
People, you know, I've got a client that always will say, I think her superpower is that she can be vulnerable and that gives her confidence and her confidence allows her to be vulnerable. But she says, I hate that word vulnerable.
Yes.
She, you know,
the first thing I'd want to do, which is by the way, one of my both tips and biggest pieces of counsel is curiosity. There is nothing, there are very few things that are more important in building connection than curiosity. The more I want to know you and the more I experience you as wanting to know me, the more connected we're going to feel. And by the way, if you say something that I vehemently disagree with, if I can get curious and wonder where that's coming from, if you give me a piece of feedback that feels really disconfirming, the more I can suspend judgment and just get curious, the more likely I am to build better connection with you.
What if the curiosity is not reciprocated?
Well, then you can get curious about why it's not being reciprocated.
There you go.
But let's go back to your question about her, about, you know, hating the word vulnerability. When I used to put the word, actually, I used to say to my students, so what's the first thing that comes up for you when I say the word vulnerability? Danger, fragile, broken, you know, there's all kinds of connotations. And then eventually somebody says strength, courage. So part of the issue is, what are the mental models that we hold about vulnerability? And can we see vulnerability, as she clearly has, as coming from strength? And can we see the cost of unwillingness to be vulnerable? Let me give you an example. So we're going to go back. I was telling you about all my different careers. We're going to go way back to my first career. So yes, I was hired as the first woman in a non-clerical job in industrial automation in 1975. 10 years later, I had risen up the ranks. I was running a $50 million business. I was running a 13 Western state sales and marketing organization. And I was at an offsite. By the way, one of the things I learned was to leave half of myself in the parking lot, the feeling part of myself and the vulnerable part of myself. Because when I was 22 years old, as the first woman, I sure as heck wasn't going to be vulnerable. And I learned what the rules of the game were, and I learned how to play them. And that's how I got to be where I was 10 years later. But now I'm at an offsite, and I'm trying to get my team excited about an idea that I've got. And I'm getting crickets. And yeah. I get a little more excited, and I'm getting crickets. And finally, I get even like, I'm like, come on, you guys, what's wrong with you? Because, of course, they were all still guys. I did finally fix that, but it took me a little longer. And one of them looked at me. Literally, Jenny looked at me, looked in my eye, and he said, is that water in the corner of your eye? Are you going to cry? And then he said, are you human after all? Mm-hmm. Are you human after all? And then I burst out crying. And I said, you don't think I'm effing human? And I use the full expletive, but since I don't know your audience, I don't want to offend anyone. And I took our agenda and I tore it up and I said, I don't think there is anything more important for all of us to talk about than that. And we spent the next 2 days talking about who we were, why we were there, what we needed, what we wanted, and what we wanted to do for each other. That's when we became a team. That's when we became unstoppable. That's when I became a leader.
Wow. You know, many people know that the key to a great team is that they know each other as humans first, not just coworkers.
Yes.
That everybody has equal a chance to participate, no passengers, and that there's diversity of thought.
And that they feel connected across their differences.
Why don't we do that? Why do the teams repeatedly will get together and they'll just start working. You know, and especially now in the Zoom world, you know, you start the meeting and you get going, and then they think, well, we'll do hot yoga and that'll make the team good.
Yeah.
We'll do hot yoga together.
No, that's right. So that goes back to your original question. During times of COVID, it's even more important to double down on the stuff that connects people. So I've got one CEO who starts every one of his meetings with his team with an activity called If You Really Knew Me, where each member of the team for 2 minutes, and by the way, we do this in my nonprofit, and that's how he learned about it. And in each team meeting, each member of the team takes 2 minutes, they time it, to say, if you really knew me.
Yeah.
So I would say, if you really knew me, you'd know that my first grandson was born 3 weeks ago. If you really knew me, you'd know that it's a good thing he was born, because I'm an obsessive compulsive. And if he hadn't been born, my obsession compulsion about launching my book would have like destroyed my marriage by now. If you really knew me, you'd know that I'm kind of distracted because my computer wasn't working earlier. If you really, and by the way, now you get to know me. If you really knew me, I hope to God there are enough people listening that they'll go out and buy my book. Now that feels vulnerable, but it doesn't feel, it feels vulnerable enough that I know, because I feel a little jitter, like, ooh, wonder if that was too much, Carol, you overselling, but not way outside my comfort zone. And hopefully people feel a little more connected to me. Now imagine what happens if a team does that every time they meet. By the way, it's a team of six. That took them 12 minutes. And now they all know a little bit more about what's going on in their lives. There's a whole other part of knowing each other that's, by the way, the class was called touchy-feely, because it was a lot more feely than touchy. And that's because the class, one of the core concepts in the class is that we don't really know each other unless we tell each other how we're feeling, which is why we had to develop a vocabulary of feelings, which is an appendix in the book. And we used to give our students, because for me to say, I'm feeling a little jittery, is different than saying, oh, I hope a lot of people buy my book. And even that's different.
Let me show up. Go ahead.
Oh, we've got questions. That's great. Well, yes.
Thierry Leroux, I think I'm saying her name right.
Yeah.
Cross-border team in Europe.
Yeah.
And what I see they need more is someone to listen to them today. We also need to let people get all their feelings out.
Yes, absolutely. And by the way, the leader sets the tone and is the role model. So if you want people to listen to each other, then you have to role model listening. If you want people to express feelings, then you have to express feelings. Mm. And you have to, I hate you have to. You'd be well advised to. and, you know, because I hate to sound very preachy. But I think if you've got a cross-cultural team, Thierry, then you also are well served to have two antenna constantly. This is also in the book. Two antenna. One is an antenna that's wired to pick up signals as to what's going on for you in the moment, so that you can make choices about what you want to say and do rather than just be reactive. The other one is to have antenna that are picking up what's going on for someone else. So that, and then within the context. And if those two antenna are really well tuned and they're talking to each other, then you'll be a better listener. You'll create more connection, and you'll create an environment with other people will feel more connected to each other.
You use the word at the beginning, the touchy-feely, and you know, there's people that really lean in and that resonates with, and then there's people that basically are coming at you saying, you know, give me the data.
Why do I
need to be, you know, touchy-feely? Is that gonna contribute to my bottom line? All this time I've got to waste touchy-feely stuff.
So
do you get that? Sometimes with clients?
I get it with some clients, and I used to get it with students. But let me tell you, after a while, when every alum said, whatever you do, don't miss this class, because this is the class that will determine how far you get, I didn't get it with students anymore. And I don't even get it with clients that much anymore, because I, to some extent, thanks to Daniel Goleman, who wrote Emotional Intelligence 25 years ago, it's now the 25th anniversary, and his research, lots of people have come around to recognizing that the soft skills are actually harder than the hard skills. And they actually turn out to make for stronger leadership and higher performance. There's tons of research that backs that up. So it's also a little bit of, you can pay a little bit now, or you could pay a lot later for not paying attention to the people part.
Yeah. What role do you think, you know, everybody's got a survey out these days.
Yes.
An instrument.
Yes.
You know, a lot of consultants like us will create one and they copyright it and sell it. You know, the ones I tend to shun are the ones that put you in one of four matrices. Or one of six.
I
like the ones that demonstrate, hey, here's yin and yang. You know, you've got strengths. The strengths taken too far can produce something that's a detriment.
Yes.
How do those different things and insights feed into your work?
So the first thing I'll say is I invite everyone to go to our website, www.connectandrelate.com, all in one word, even though the book is Connect. You'll find a free assessment.
And I printed it out.
Oh, there you go, that you can download. And to your point, it's about What are some of your areas of strength when it comes to some of the things you need to do to be interpersonally effective? And what are some of the areas you might want to work on? And by the way, then give the assessment to someone in your life who you'd like to be more connected to and see whether they assess you the same way you assess you. And then you've got a lot to talk about.
Yeah. The one I liked that I've seen most teams are poor at, you know, most good teams will basically say, "Hey, Carol, anything you need, just call me."
Yeah.
Very few people are, "Carol, I need help.
Yeah.
I'm struggling."
Yeah.
And again, I think it goes back to being vulnerable or weak. But
absolutely.
But, I mean, talk to us about how asking for help actually strengthens a team and creates better connections.
Well, you just said it. First of all, if I don't ask for help, I don't have the benefit of someone else's, you know, knowledge and expertise. Second of all, if I don't ask you for help, you're going to feel a lot more vulnerable asking me for help. Vulnerability is reciprocal. Third of all, if I have to worry about the story you're going to make up about me if I ask for help, then I'm going to be even less inclined to ask you for help, which is why another concept that's very important in the book is about how there are really three realities in any interaction between two people, which is what's going on for me, what I do and say, which is the only reality we both know, and what's going on for you. And so unless I create opportunities for me to tell you what's going on in mine, and you to tell me what's going on in yours, then we only have 2/3 of the data. And then we don't have a very functional exchange.
Well, and that relates also, again, one of the things you probably do as an executive coach is spend a lot of time helping people have difficult conversations.
Absolutely.
Or provide feedback. Number 22 on your list is treat feedback, whether given or received, as information, not demand for change.
Yes. So we in the book, we talk about, first of all, some very practical tools for how to give feedback in ways that are less likely to cause defensiveness. Mm-hmm. Second, and then how to receive feedback in ways that no matter how that's given, you can keep your defensiveness down. And then the point we're talking about constructive feedback, I'd like to get back to feedback on your strengths and how to leverage them. Because we think of feedback as, you know, always telling you something you could do better or you're doing wrong. And the purpose of feedback is to move into a problem-solving conversation. Something isn't working here. Let's figure out how to move into what am I doing that's contributing to this? What are you doing? What could we do together? As opposed to you need to change. I don't know if we have time for another anecdote, but I have a great anecdote.
Yeah, no, that's great. And you just, you might remember the book Coaching for Improved Performance by Fer Ferdinand. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what he said was, you've got, until you both agree, you can't move into that joint problem solving.
Right. Right.
And go ahead with your anecdote.
Well, and in fact, leaders especially, I think one of a leader's most important jobs is to develop others. You can't develop others unless you give them feedback. And you have to give them feedback in ways that they feel affirmed. And which, by the way, also means you have to include your intent. I'm telling you this because I'm invested in you. And the fact that you arrive late every time the last three times we've had a meeting, you've arrived late, and I'm getting more and more irritated by that. What's going on? What do we do? Do we need to change the times of the meetings? Do you not realize it's irritating me? Right. But here's my anecdote. This is also in the book. Years ago, this is a personal anecdote, but everybody will relate, I suspect. Many years ago, because my son is now 33, my son was 16 years old, 17, close to 17, and he was going to go on the college tour to go look at colleges. Now, we live in Palo Alto, California. He was going to go east to look at colleges because, of course, God forbid he should go to well-known Western business schools that are right across the street. He was going to go, and his dad was going to take him on this trip. So, my son Nick comes into the kitchen. And he says, Mom, please don't send me on this trip with Dad because it's going to be, you've got to take me. I said, Nick, I can't take you. Our spring breaks don't correspond. And, you know, you got to go during your spring break. I'm not going to pull you out of school. You're going to have to go with your dad. I said, but why don't you want to go with your dad? He says, oh, Mom, you know, Dad, he is going to drive me crazy. He's going to be at the front of every line at every college campus with a million questions. All the other kids are going to say, oh, my God, that poor kid, that's his dad. Can you imagine? Then we're going to get in the car and he's going to have a million questions for me. Okay, what'd you think of this? I like their library better than theirs. I really like that professor. What do you think? He said, please don't send us. And I said, first of all, I'm not sending you. You're going. It's your choice. But it sounds like you've got feedback for your father. Now, at that point, if you have teenage kids, you know the teenage eye roll. I get, how could I have not known that's what your response was going to be? But then he said, but Mom, won't that hurt his feelings? And I said, what do you think will hurt his feelings more? For him, for you not to even give him a chance or tell him that this is a problem and never even resolve it, or for you to tell him? So that night, you know, at the dinner table, he said, you know, Mom, Dad, no, he said in the kitchen, Mom, will you tell him? I said, that's not how it works. So that night he said, so Dad, Mom says I have to tell you something. I don't care how you get into it. But then he said, you know, this is, I'm worried, this is what's going to happen. And now Andy, my husband of many years, having learned many of the things I teach, the first words out of his mouth, what do you think they were?
Why do you feel this way? What? Thanks for telling me.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you so much for caring enough about our relationship to tell me. Mm-hmm. I bet that was hard for you. I mean, I could feel Nick's shoulders just relax. And then Andy said, what shall we do about it? And then they got into a problem solving conversation where they decided they would park the car at each campus at a place certain. They'd agree to meet back there at a place certain, and they could both go their separate ways. And they might join the same tour or not, but nobody would know they were related. Andy could still be the Energizer Bunny at the front of the line. Nick could wander off if he wanted. They would meet back at the car. Andy agreed to wait until Nick said, okay, Dad, I'm ready to talk about this place instead of last place. They had a phenomenal trip. It completely changed their relationship. Nick did go east. And by the way, the bookend of that story is that Nick came back to a well-known Palo Alto-based business school. And when he did, he called Andy and said, hey, Dad, how about a road trip? Why don't we bring all my stuff back together?
What a great story.
The next time you're worried that feedback's going to ruin a relationship, remember the Andy Nick story.
Yeah, that's awesome. Hey, Carol, if you knew me better, I would have told Nick, suck it up, buttercup.
And it would have been interesting to see how that impacted your relationship.
Yeah, no, I'm being honest and being facetious both. It's a really good, you know, you gotta be in the moment and take a step back. That's great advice. There's two other things I wanted to cover before we go. Given the COVID environment and the fact that so many people not only are working on, you know, personal connections in their organizations and personal and family, but with clients, I mean, what advice do you have for people that are looking to connect in a way that creates a competitive advantage over their competitors with their clients, that they can connect better? Any hacks you've got?
I mean, I think the same principles apply, which is first, see them as people. See them as people that are perhaps struggling with some of the same things you're struggling with. make it easier for them to feel known and seen, not just as yet another order or yet another transaction, but as another human being that you actually care about, regardless of the transaction. And it, it I think this is the thing that I find so interesting, that most people think, oh God, you know, that's touchy feely soft stuff, but we're back to people do business with people. And if I've got somebody who made me feel just a little bit better that I spent a half an hour with them than someone else, I'm going to want to spend more time with them. And if I'm going to spend more time with them, by the way, I might also be a little more open to their influence. And maybe, I was in sales for a long time. Sales gets a bad rap. Sales is really about influence. Sales about being about being of service. If you're selling something you believe in. And so I don't know how you do that without connection of some kind.
Right. Oh, I think that's great counsel. The other thing I wanted to ask you about was humor.
Yeah.
And you've got a couple of things, you know, avoid using humor as zingers or a way to make points indirectly. And then the other one is use humor to connect with others and bring them closer. So that can be a tough one these days, given our social, political climate and everything else that's going on. What's your counsel there?
Well, let me say two things. The first is humor can be immensely connecting. And in fact, one of my colleagues has just put out a book on humor that actually was released yesterday, also from the business school. And it's too often used as a substitute for being direct, as a substitute for talking about something uncomfortable. As a substitute for actually taking a risk. So I used a little humor earlier when I talked about my obsessive compulsive nature. That was a little easier for me to do. And it was a little less risky than to tell you about the price I've paid in my life for being such an obsessive compulsive, but maybe a little less connecting. Yes, and now I want to address quite specifically your point about how the environment, the political environment, the social environment, the 2020 was a year of so much strife on so many fronts, particularly politically and after George Floyd, that what worries me most is that people are talking less, not more. And they're talking less about the things they ought to be talking about because they're afraid. Oh my gosh, I'm going to step in a pile of doo-doo. I'm going to say the wrong thing. And you know what? We don't get better at learning how to connect across differences and talk about it in ways that build relationship if we don't talk about it. We actually have to be willing to talk about it, take a small risk and say, yeah, I'm going to say something. And if it lands wrong, I want you to know my intent here was to understand or to have a better sense of what's going on for you. And by the way, when somebody asks me, so what's it like? What was it like being a woman in a male-dominated environment? That is asking me to speak on behalf of all women. But when somebody asks me, so Carol, what was your experience of being in that? And what did you learn from that? And what did people do that was helpful and not helpful? Now they're just asking. It's not a sociological interrogation. They're asking me about me and my experience. And now we can have more of a conversation. And then I can say, well, here's what worked for me. Well, I know other women for whom that doesn't work. Some, my male colleague will say, and I'll say, yeah, that's why you've got to ask. And that's why you've got to be able to have the conversations. There's a famous poet, Adrienne Rich, who a line from her poems says, that which remains unspoken becomes unspeakable.
Ah, wow. That's profound. As we kind of wrap up, I can't help but think about trust.
Yes.
And it's talked about so much.
Yes.
There's so many ways to achieve it. You know, part of it is being vulnerable. Part of it is doing what you say you're going to do. I think part of it is trusting and giving responsibility. But it's easy to say, hey, if we don't have trust, you know, we don't have the foundation of a team.
Right.
But very few people have talked about, well, how do we achieve trust and sustain it? And well, it sounds to me like that's a big part of your work.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot about this in the book, and I would say two things. The first is we talk a lot about something called repair, the power of repair. I say something, it lands poorly, it doesn't produce what I had hoped it would produce. How do we repair that? And how do we repair it when it's just small so that we have a little bit of trust? If it's been broken, we can repair it and be back. But if we don't learn to repair, then we also don't learn that we also don't take any chances. And then we don't deepen relationships. And trust is built incrementally. So as I take bigger and bigger risks, if we haven't learned to repair along the way, then it feels even riskier because, wow, if I tell you this and you write me off entirely, how do we ever even come back from that? So, you know, we need to learn. These are skills and tools we need to learn. And most of us don't know. And in fact, the last chapter of the book is a real story of my co-author and me who had a huge fight. We had an exceptional relationship. We'd been colleagues and friends. We had a huge fight. I said I would never talk to him again because by the time you get that far in trusting somebody when they do something that disappoints you, in my case, when he did what he did, or in fact didn't do what he didn't do, I felt so betrayed that I couldn't imagine ever wanting to be in a relationship with him again. And that chapter is about how we came back. And not only did we come back and rebuild our relationship, it became even stronger afterward. And otherwise, we would have never written a book together.
Wow. It reminds me of the work I've done with my students. And before the project, I'll always say, you've got to do a teamwork alignment. And part of that alignment is talk about all the places where this is going to go wrong.
Right.
And what you're going to do when it does.
Yep.
And that way, when things happen, you can say, oh, well, this is to be expected. And
right.
We knew this would happen, and we said we'd repair it this way. And
right.
I think that's what you're saying, that, again, being vulnerable, taking risks is a little bit about positioning that I'm going to do my best, but if
right.
it doesn't land well, let's talk about how I kind of explain what I'm really
right.
trying to say in a,
right.
a better way.
And that's why one of the hallmarks of exceptional relationships is a relationship where we're both committed to each other's growth and learning.
Yeah.
And I mean, we both deal productively with conflict. We both are honest with each other. We trust that our disclosures won't be used against us. We're willing to be vulnerable and fully ourselves. I mean, that's the whole gamut. And obviously relationships exist on a continuum. Our contention is you may not have very many relationships in your life that are all of that. In fact, maybe you don't even have the capacity. You know, 4 or 5 might be fantastic because maybe you only have 1 or 2. But every relationship can move along that continuum, along those, and be more robust, more functional, more productive, and frankly, more meaningful and fulfilling.
Yeah. Hey, we're kind of running out of time, but we just got another comment in.
Yeah.
And let me throw it up here. I think you'll recognize this person.
Yes, be to your fungal cord, trying to open up communication channels with mentors who aren't willing to meet us halfway. Well, the first thing I would do is I would start by getting curious. Why do you think they're not meeting you halfway? What would be the reason? Do they not recognize that's what you're trying to do? Do they not care? Do they not see that reciprocating might be to their benefit? So first I'd get curious. And second, I'd get curious with myself with regard to what is it that I'm asking for and how am I asking? And am I conveying my intent in the asking in the mm-hmm. way that that makes it more likely that they will play ball? There's
yeah.
There's a whole chapter in the book between a father and a daughter and the daughter's trying to get the dad to do all kinds of things the dad's just not willing to do. And there's some more, way many more tools in that chapter than what I can do in a minute.
Yeah. And here's my attempt at humor. Is part of it helping older parents with technology?
Absolutely. 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 And by the way, I'm not saying there's not a role for humor. It's always, I mean, you just don't use it as an excuse.
Yeah, that's great. Great counsel. Carol, I've just absolutely loved speaking with you. You're going to be on the Leadership Podcast in a few months. So we'll be able to have a little bit longer conversation then as well. And I know you're going to be a hot commodity on the talk circuit. So this book comes out February 9th, if I remember correctly.
Yes, a week from yesterday. But it can be pre-ordered now. It's available now. It'll ship on the 9th. Some people have even gotten theirs a little early. It's just, you know, if you look up Connect Carol Robin on any, on your favorite book publishing place. And by the way, one last tip. Buy two. At least buy one for you and one for somebody you care about in your life and read them together. You know, you can take the sales out of the girl. You can take the girl out of sales, never sales out of the girl. If you have a team, consider buying one for every member of your team. If you want a bulk order, go to our website, connect and relate.
Name two or people that have endorsed it off the tip of your tongue.
Ray Dalio, Reid Hoffman, Adam Grant.
There you go. Yeah. I just wanted you to name drop because you got some pretty great endorsements. So
thank you.
That's awesome.
Thank you.
Carol, it's a pleasure speaking with you. And again, thanks for coming on today.
Thank you. Really a pleasure. And I look forward to our next meeting.
All right. Thank you.